These sessions were set up to deal with the kind of affirmations that one hears on every side, that we have 25 years, or man is going to 25 years really to do something about his environment, or we aren't going to be able to live anymore. And one really reads those statements by responsible people, that the way in which we have treated our environment, the way in which we're pouring pollutants into the environment is such that in our irresponsibility, we're beginning to create conditions under which life will be impossible. And the only variations you get among some of the students of the environment is the length of time it's going to take for this to happen. And that some say 25 and others 100. Unless something radical is done. And we started out about 12 sessions ago to examine some of these statements and to see what it would mean to take some responsibility. And I'd just like to summarize where I am and what I've gotten out of these sessions as a relative newcomer to this whole field. First, and we decided to focus on energy, so all of this comes out of energy, and a lot of other things that might be. First, we need new sources of energy. A, to preserve the reserves of oil and gas now in short supply in this country, and in short supply in the not too distant future in the rest of the world. This won't be any oil and gas within a relatively short period of time anywhere. Second, that is if we keep using it the rate we're using it. Second, to meet the demands of an increased consumption if present levels of consumption are maintained. So we need new sources of energy. I like to form things in propositions and then keep testing them, seeing if people agree or disagree. Second, viable new sources of energy are in sight. From nuclear fission, for sure, and nuclear fusion, probably, within 40 or 50 years. And these sources will be less polluting than the present one. Third, problems of pollution from the production of energy can be handled. I don't see that anybody has yet shown that they can't be handled. They probably will not be handled without public regulation. Fourth, the cost of pollution control should be added to the cost of fuel and paid for by the consumer. Fifth, the metals at present considered necessary to continue our present levels of production are in very short supply in many instances. Sixth, our present technology depends upon resources from other countries now and will be more dependent on imports in the future. In some cases, our reserves are non-existent or limited. Seventh, at present levels of per capita consumption, either our population must be reduced our future generations will have, I put drastically in quotation marks, drastically reduced standards of living. We cannot continue to produce and consume at our present levels. There simply aren't enough metals in the world. Eighth, the doctrine of nature as a part of God's creation establishes grounds other than the practical ones thus far suggested for concern for our natural resources and our natural environment. That's the subject for today, and I give you the propositions. Namely, the doctrine of nature as a part of God's creation establishes grounds other than the practical ones, which is all we've been talking about thus far, for concern for our natural resources and our natural environment. Ninth, the doctrine of nature is a part of God's creation, and hence is meaningful in itself, implies the notion that consumption of nature is always ambiguous, and hence must be done with real restraint. Tenth, the change of lifestyle with less utilization of natural resources per capita is thus in order. 11th, the change in lifestyle makes much less clear the practical imperative to reduce our population, a favorite imperative now that you hear everywhere. So that what I want to deal with is the last propositions today, beginning with the doctrine of nature as a part of God's creation, establishes grounds other than the present ones for a real control of our consumption and production. Now, it seems to me that our primary concern, what I call a theological concern, is to place nature in the totality of being. That is, what is the place of nature in the world, or in being, or what you might call God's economy? By nature here, I'm talking about the inorganic world, the physical and chemical world, and the organic world, the biological world. What is the place of nature? Not only the nature that's a part of us, but the nature which doesn't express the kind of dimensions, the psychological and spiritual dimensions, or if it does, it doesn't in to much less degree than man. Now, Lynn White Jr., who's written a book, accuses the Christians of being responsible for the environmental crisis. The reason that we have an environmental crisis in Western civilization is because the Christian faith has affirmed that God created the world of nature and gave man dominion over it. But the reason that we have a real crisis in Western civilization is that it's over against a primitive culture in which spirit existed in nature as well as in man, so-called theories of animism, where spirits were in trees and in all kinds of non-human reality. The Western world, on the basis of the Christian doctrine of nature, or the Christian, what he calls anthropocentrism, namely that the world was created for man and everything is created for man and man is supposed to subdue it. But this doctrine has created complete irresponsibility on the part of man for nature. So what man does then is to rape nature without any sense of nature having any meaning except insofar as it's useful to man. And he says, I personally doubt that disastrous ecological backlash can be avoided simply by applying to our problems more science and more technology. Our science and technology have grown out of Christian attitudes towards man's relation to nature, which are almost universally held not only by Christians and neo-Christians, but also by those who fondly regard themselves as post-Christians. Despite Copernicus, all the cosmos rotates around our little globe. Despite Darwin, we are not in our hearts part of the natural process. We are superior to nature, contemptuous of it, willing to use it for our slightest whim. The newly elected governor of California, like myself, a churchman, but less troubled than I, spoke for the Christian tradition when he said, as is alleged, when you've seen one redwood tree, you've seen them all. To a Christian, a tree can be no more than a physical fact. The whole concept of the sacred grove is alien to Christianity and to the ethos of the West. For nearly two millennia, Christian missionaries have been chopping down sacred groves, which are idolatrous, because they assume spirit in nature. Now I would like to examine Genesis, which is the source of this doctrine, and think about it a little, and see if he's not right. That is to say, to see if the source, for most Christians at least, of their fundamental belief, the Bible, does not really assert this doctrine. So it gives those of us who at least start with the Bible, if we don't finish with it completely, a real cause for pause if we question this doctrine, which Lynn White is questioning. And I don't know how much of this story is so familiar to read.
Elder, you did mention Lynn White is a Christian.
That's right. That is, he's not attacking Christianity from the outside. He's really attacking it from the inside. But he's really raising a question about our doctrine of nature. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, one day. And God said, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let separate the waters from the waters." And God made the firmament, and separated the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven. And there was evening, and there was morning, a second day. So then he creates the earth. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas. And God saw that it was good. Creates the sun. And God said, "Let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth, across the firmament of the heavens." So God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm, according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters and the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth." So, and it goes on, sometimes it repeats, and God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, cattle and creeping things, and beasts of the earth according to their kind." And it was so, and God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds, and the cattle according to their kind, and everything that creeps upon the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And then we come to the crucial passage. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the earth, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. Let us make man in our image." We'd have to say man and woman or something today. We couldn't get away with that, could we? We couldn't have that, having woman create a man's rib today. At any rate, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea," that dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. It's a little bit different from the rib story here. And God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it." And subdue it. "Have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth." Now that's the ground White claims for man's subduing and having dominion, and in a sense treating and having. If we are going to suggest there was a completely different doctrine in the church, where Francis talk to the birds, that's the myth at least, the story. There's a kind of meaning in a bird's life. I happen to like birds, so you get a lot of emphasis on birds here, but it might be a cat. I like cats too. Most cats, except the one we have now, and I like him too, but I've got a few problems with him. But at any rate, there's a meaning in the life or the anything that's created in and of itself. Now my affirmation is that we have not developed the doctrine of nature in the church. And we have not developed, I would say, that the fundamental, now I would get to my own constructive position, that we have not made union with anything except people and God meaningful in our Christian theology, for the most part. I wouldn't generalize, like Jim said yesterday, you got all kinds of theology. But for the most part, truth, for example, is instrumental. I don't know what we do with beauty. I just don't know what we Protestants do with beauty. But all these things, it seems to me, have a meaning and a value and are cherished by God. So that it isn't simply our fellowship with each other, but it's our fellowship with nature. And we fellowship with nature in learning about it and just knowing. When you walk around here or through the woods or across the campus or anywhere, the world is just full of a lot of reality that we don't relate to, we don't fellowship with. And it's other than human. And I think I'm really interested in developing a doctrine, and I think this is fundamental for handling the ecological crisis. And with this, I agree with White. Because it seems to me the fundamental understandings of things are what finally determine what happens. There are a lot of practical things that also determine. But finally, in the long haul of a civilization or a culture, your fundamental understandings are what determine what you do. And it seems to me we have not developed a doctrine in which a tree or a bird or a mountain or a stream kind of have a life and meaning, and in some sense have spirit, although they either have spirit or potentiality for spirit, so they can't be treated simply instrumentally. And that raises real problems then when you have to destroy them or use them. But I say you use anything like you use a person. You do it at the risk of destroying the person, and if you don't take the meaning and the being of a person seriously in terms of what a person is, you destroy a relationship. And that doesn't mean that there isn't meaning in using a person and in being related to a person in some way that serves your purposes, but if you don't treat the other as having a purpose and intention and a meaning in and of itself, then you destroy it. And I think the same is true of nature. And our problem, I think, is that we have not developed any doctrine of nature. That is, that's the basic problem in ecology. And hence we can use it without any thought of its meaning and without any real sense of tragedy. See, I think we can't get into a very morbid state and say, well, you know, it's terrible to eat. We ought not to enjoy it, because I think the union with food should be a sacrament. It's enjoyable. It's love. Using Tillich here now, the union with food, union with nature, union with form, truth, union with beauty, union with people, union with God. They're all love, all way in which we embody love, and hence ought to be sacramental. And then you get into this real dilemma. Well, you can't really use some things without destroying them almost, or just really without real problems. What are you going to do about eating meat? Or what are you going to do about eating plants? Do it with a sense of the ambiguity, and do it with joy, with a sense of tragedy, And I don't see those two things as necessarily making us morbid or making us not have joy in it. Well, that's kind of what I wanted to say, is the ground for making some choices about styles of life and this kind of endless consumption and productivity in which we're involved. Because if we take this seriously, then we're going to use what we need, but we're not going to use a lot of stuff just to have new styles of cars or to have new clothes, or, you know, and all these things that we do, which are so unnecessary, it seems to me, or to destroy a mountain or a view, or those redwoods really did impress me. I just walked through those redwoods and drove through them slowly and camped under them, and I said to myself, 500 years to build a redwood, you know, you just feel something is embodied here, and you feel small and impermanent, and you think, my God, the creative energy and life and meaning here in these redwoods, and you slash them down. You can't create them. Now, I say, if you think of a redwood that way, as over against, well, he supplies wood for something and termites don't use it and so forth, and we don't want termites. I don't think I've got any redwood. I don't know any redwood around Chicago. There must be some around Chicago. Well, you don't need, you know, I mean, the use of it ought to be done with a sense, well, it's a tragedy, but I might use a little of it. Now, unless we develop that and embody it in institutions, it seems to me, we will rape nature, continue to rape nature. Paul?
I wonder if it would be helpful to try to get some response on people to see how they, whether they're aware of the statement, with your point, how they feel. And I thought it might help if I repeated a little bit since I described you as a student by this summer. Very bright guy. We were talking, I don't know how we got into this, business of the rights of nature. Mm-hmm. And the student looked at me rather bewildered way. And then I said, outside of Butte, Montana, there used to be nice highways wound up across the mountains. And then they built the Integrated Highway. They just blasted out the rock and now you just sail up at an easy grade. And then I said, I don't think man has any right to do that to a mountain. If you want to go across the mountain on the road, you have to sort of follow the contours of the mountain. Well, there were several students who, you know, their eyes sort of lit up, they got both still cheerful, they were nodding. But this one guy said, that's a lot of mystical crap. And then he went on, and, you know, you can think of, if we took that attitude, we'd never even think of all of the accidents. How many lives would say by building the interstate? Now, can you get this sort of dialogue going? As soon as he said that, a lot of mystical crap, all the guys dried up. is that a lot of mystical crap, or does it not mean that right?
As a scientist, I'd like to have this input at this point, I think. I really believe that Al has now brought us to the point of the fundamental question, really, that we should get to. And, you know, it's been very difficult for the scientific community to be a part of the church. I think you just think about this. It has been very difficult for the scientific community to have an input into things that were theological and is related to what you refer to as a doctrine that embraces nature. The church has fundamentally been on the opposite side of science. And I think this is not compatible with either the Bible or any other stance that one might take. It is not consistent, because I think I read many things in the Bible that says man is a part of nature, should be a part of the total creation of God. Furthermore, that every other animal and plant is a part of this. I really think that we need to do some rethinking and re-educating in our seminaries, in our colleges, Sunday school, right on through to bring about a change in attitude, really, toward nature. And we have not faced this, and the church still is very skeptical of science, per se. I think, maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I'd say a few cookies, too. I think it's very important that we get this thing moving. I said yesterday that theology is a very diverse enterprise, and that it's possible to say that in general, the scientific community has had a difficult time relating to the church. I think that's true. And I think there's too much truth in Len White, you know, to be comfortable with it. But I agree very much with the position that you outlined, and I agree, Rudy, with what you said. I guess maybe I would just like to state without expanding some ways in which the church has worked with this question, just a couple of handles. For instance, Thomas Aquinas, way the world back there, organized the whole faith around the categories of nature and grace, and his fundamental sentence is, grace never destroys, but always fulfills nature. Well, that's really a tremendous resource out of which the church could work to develop a doctrine of nature. Or Bonhoeffer, for instance, has a section in his Ethics where he talks about the rediscovery of the natural, and he alludes to the fact that, you know, we, particularly in the Protestant Church, that word has been a negative word, that we've got to rediscover that. It's been a negative word because we've connected it with supernature and thought that everything worthwhile is supernatural, so that's a disaster. We have to connect the word natural rather with unnatural. That which is natural is good. It's directed in accordance with God's use of his purpose for his creation. That which is unnatural is bad because we frustrate God's purpose with his creation. So that's another little set of categories. I think another thing to say is that the church has always been worried about pantheism on one hand and theism on the other. Pantheism, which says nature equals God. The church has rightly been saying we are not pantheists. And the other is theism, which says God made the world, but he doesn't have anything to do with it now. So the church has always tried to guard against those two ditches. And recently, John Robinson, some process theologians are using the word pan-n-theism. Not pantheism, not everything equals God, but panentheism, God is in everything and everything is in God. I think that's a useful theological resource to work at a doctrine of nature. There's a fellow by the name of Jacques Serrano, who has a book, The Meaning of the Body. He talks about post-dualism. I think that's another helpful phrase, in which he says, you have pantheism, everything equals God, everything is spirit. He says in the West, there has been developed a certain dualism which is part of the whole scientific process. You have to isolate a thing. You have to objectify it in a way. If you're going to operate on a person, you have to think about that appendix as an objective thing that is removable. And he says that's good, but it has had unfortunate results in the objectification of nature, you know, separating it from life. So he says, we don't want to go back to pantheism or animism, but we have to go forward to post-dualism, in which we bring matter and spirit together again, but in a new sense. That's another category. And maybe the last of these little handles would be New Delhi, 1961, World Council of Churches, in which Joe Sittler took off on Colossians 1:15-20,
and talked about the cosmic Christ and the Christic cosmos. That is a way of saying it's not just that God the Father is related to the world, but Jesus is related to our soul. Jesus Christ is so tied in with the cosmos that we can call it a Christic cosmos, and the cosmos is so tied in with Christ that we can talk about him as the cosmic Christ. Well, that's just to suggest that there have been a lot of people working on this. There are some handles, there are some resources. I would agree wholeheartedly that there's a long way to go, and there's a lot of work that has to be done.
Well, I think the important thing is, from my point of view at least, is to ask some questions, other than practical ones,
yeah,
about this issue. And, but not to avoid the practical ones, because it seems to me that somehow theology has to deal with the practical issues that science raises, but put it in a context which sees the meaning of these practical issues in the whole of creation and salvation. Paul?
What Woody said about the conflict between science and Christianity is certainly true, and yet I think we should keep in mind there is another sense in which science is a product of Christianity, and the attitude with which science has approached the world is this attitude that Lynn White criticized. I think science learned from Christianity that the world can be put on the rack. You can manipulate things as much as you need to in order to get the results that you want. You see statements in scientific publications frequently about the good. You can't say that anything is good except insofar as some human being says it's good. Just this attitude. Wouldn't you agree, Rudy, that, of course, it's not characteristic of all scientists, and maybe scientists, when they're at work with their material, develop a kind of respect for it. But nonetheless, there's the attitude that nature is something that we can't manipulate. We can make plastics, we can synthesize, rearrange. It's there for our use. This idea that the marked, forward march of science, triumphant march of science. That is, science is man's tool, not so much for getting to know the universe better, as his tool for triumphing over creation. That idea.
Well, I think the question of yes, there's something has happened here that isn't right. Is it the scientist's fault, or is it the church's fault that this tack has been taken? See, there are many of the early scientists that were really preachers to begin with, because, you know, they were theologians originally. They got their education through this kind of a source, and they developed then this concept of nature, but they were really excluded from the church whenever they really developed anything in the realm of nature. They were not a part of the church at this point. And furthermore, this doctrine of subdue and dominate and so on gave the ground for this kind of thing to proceed. I really don't think that you can point to the scientist and say that, yes, he really took off on the wrong tack and that he still is on the wrong road. I agree, and I can't defend many of my peers in their attitude theologically. But I'm afraid the church has really, in a sense, divorced us and put us on this track.
Yeah, whatever has happened is some concern, but I guess not a great concern to me in terms of who's responsible.
Yeah, I think the
important thing, to me at least, is what kind of understandings are true and therefore ought to be talked about and taught, and the ground for our own living.
Well, I'm one of those science men that history. Our flood times, and when there's a lot of science that's not practical, we know this very well. And then what man does with the tools that God gives us, we find out the truth, and we use it usually for war purposes. And finally get around to using it for something that might be of value to mankind and also to nature. And we can mine through the sun, we can mine the land, and I don't think we're destroying anything when we're growing crops. Not necessarily, at least if we put something back when we take it out. And this is one of the laws of nature. You can't take things, you can mine a mine like you mine up here for copper, and eventually it's all gone. But the copper was not destroyed, it's scattered all over the world. We're going to have to learn to reuse these automobiles and these junkyards that you've got and separate them out. We aren't destroying the stuff. It's here and it is not possible to destroy.
What about the burning of petroleum? Isn't that destroying?
It is destroyed as petroleum. But the carbon dioxide in water open to nature is not destroyed at all. And the sunlight can make the oils and we can grow palm nuts several times to the acre. And we can make a substitute for the petroleum and use the petroleum for what it's good for, other than destroying it and putting it in the atmosphere. That's a little take for other forms of fact.
I guess I have another practical doctrine that has been introduced, and that's kind of mankind. If you have nature, then you have mankind. Mankind is a very indefinite kind of reality. And therefore the use is a practical reason. Therefore, if you take mankind even and say, well, the use to man is a real concern. It's not just use to us, it's use to all of mankind. That'd be another real reason, it seems to me, for the limitation of the use and the careful use and husbandry, really, of all resources that somehow support and sustain what I call the necessities of life. So against the luxuries, which... man has been on Earth, what, 1 million years? And supposedly be on Earth another 1 million years. And while one can't predict what will happen, I think one can't live apart from people, man, who are going to live on the Earth 1 million years from now. And one has some sense of stewardship, therefore, for the conditions of life. Without trying to control it, but it gives you another principle for not just wasting resources or polluting the lakes. And, well, a lake isn't going to die for another 100 years. So, why not, it'll die, but not in my lifetime.
Well, I think you have an important word there, and that's stewardship. I guess I can disagree with Paul a little bit. The mountain has some rights, and probably there are places where you shouldn't build a superhighway. I think God gave us a brain to figure out where man's rights and the lives of man overcome the rights of the mountain. Probably there are places you should build a superhighway so not so many humans will suffer. But in building that superhighway in that place, maybe you should respect the rights of the mountain and try to make it as beautiful as possible. And on the other hand, there are probably places where man shouldn't build a superhighway because he doesn't have to and doesn't need to. And that's where the stewardship comes in. It's like maybe typhoid germs have some rights. And, they're part of nature. And man can use his technology to do some good things, but he has to be careful that he doesn't just get carried away and just go charging out to triumph over everything. Man's gotten carried away with the fact that we can just do things, and we've forgotten that man also needs nature, some wilderness, and some quiet. But that's where the stewardship comes in. Think man has, maybe in any given situation, there'd be a different decision.
Exactly. And you text it, you're talking because the criteria really is still man. So when you talk about the rights of the bottom, there is some places where we shouldn't go, because we don't need it, you said. That is, when you said that, you build it so that it's beautiful, and it's beautiful for man. And I think that you're saying that you're reflecting the way most of us instinctively we monitor the situation. I like to jump over to the other side. I'm very sympathetic with what Al said. And he did refer to the ambiguity here. And what about this possibility? That man is completely natural. That what man does is just as natural as anything else. Man is kind of the crown of creation, the leading edge, and his intelligence, his consciousness, his creative and transforming power is the only norm that we have for deciding what to be done. Now, he should be intelligent, he should use his brain, but he indeed is the dominant being within nature. I think that's the way most of us have long felt. And I'm not sure it's wrong. I don't like it.
Well, I don't see the problem, you see, Paul. Because I can't say that he's only a part of nature, but nature certainly in man provides the conditions for spirit, and spirit isn't present certainly to the same degree. We get into all kinds of problems now in talking about it in any way in other life, so that at the one and the same time you have to recognize the meaning of all existence, but a kind of hierarchy of existence. And that makes it very ambiguous, because you are the highest, and spirit is the most real thing, in some sense, that we know. I mean, real, most valuable, the height of meaning.
I heard something that was useful, I think, in the context of what Paul just said, and what you were saying too about this thing in nature. And it was built on this word subdue, which was that we can all talk about subduing nature, but if we get in there and we tinker around with all this stuff, and for instance, I know, who's that guy that wrote the population law? Paul Ehrlich. Mm-hmm. Ehrlich was saying, well, we're getting into an area, say, and we till the soil, or we break the land that should be broken up, and the dust gets up in the air, cuts out quite a bit of the sun's radiation that gets through, and this causes climatic changes, you know, and the whole bit. Well, see, then we're not really subduing nature, but it's coming around that nature is you know, it's going to get its, you know, instead of we subduing nature by mixing ourselves into something that maybe was a little big for us, or by doing it in an unintelligent way, or in a way that's ignorant of the actual realities. We're going to be subdued by nature, and perhaps, like it, you know, as an agent of nature, man perhaps fills the atmosphere with all this junk, and this stuff kills him. Well, did he subdue nature? No, nature subdued man. So that perhaps to truly subdue nature, if you want, you know, this is just to build it on this one word, to truly subdue nature, it's got to be done with a full knowledge of the total reality of the situation. And this may well mean that we, you know, that we're going to have to hold back and you know, sort of not be so sure that we know exactly what to do, and maybe that this would come out in this, maybe recognizing that things have a sort of a reality which we can't ignore,
You know, just like this, what we're doing might change the whole climate of the earth, you know? And are we ready for that? Can we handle that? I think that was kind of good, because it sort of brings these two things together. The reality of nature, which may in fact subdue us, even though at first it seems that we're subduing the nature.
So, try to make rain, don't they? You need rain because your neighbor might not want it.
You know, I think there's a difference between use and abuse. Mm-hmm. When we speak of abuse, then that goes beyond normal use. I think it's what we've done.
There's a difference, but to me, it's not as radical as a lot of people think. Because any use, in some sense, threatens to be an abuse. And I think that Keith was kind of pointed to that in the sense that there is an interdependence and that eventually life may have the imperative that you may establish apart from yourself because of the meaning of another existence may come back because there is an interrelatedness in life, and you simply can't avoid taking somebody else and other reality seriously in terms of its own existence because you're related to it. And you may think you can for a while, but you really are. So that what we're trying to say in terms of trying to understand the meaning of other being other than human may be, in a sense, guaranteed or revealed in the natural process itself. That is to say that you will find in due time that your being is threatened if you don't take other beings seriously and see it as a part of creation. You can get a kind of, I think, doctrine here that you can find in the natural carrying out of life the basis for a principle that you might establish without that kind of natural proof. And so that if you took the notion in Genesis that the creation is good and therefore is meaningful in all of its aspects as a doctrine, you might find that life proves that doctrine. That's kind of getting two sources. And that's what I heard Keith saying. I don't know whether this makes sense to you or not. But
I think along this same line, there's a theological problem or question that arises out of this. If man really can learn and understand nature and can understand God, and now then creates the power through fission, fusion, to the point that he has the ability to do these things, then if you see, man begins to think that he is God. And this is one of the great dangers in the scientific community, is that really the only problems we have are one of understanding, and once we understand, we can do whatever we wish. We do not need the concept of God any further. We are God, and there are people who feel this way. And it really is a matter of knowing more. And finally, when we gain this superlative knowledge, we are. You see, and I think this leads us down a false trail.
Well, now I'd be interested in if I know that we can't establish a doctrine by asserting it or by suggesting it. And I don't know how you establish doctrines. I've never been clear as to why I believe what I believe exactly. But I think I believe that nature has a meaning for God in and of itself, and that I destroy some of that meaning. And this is a mystery to me, why it is that I have to destroy something which has a kind of a meaning apart from me in order to live. That's really ambiguous. It just seems to be part of the human situation. That's what I believe. Now the question is, and I don't really want to stop this discussion of the doctrine, but the meaning of the doctrine is the way in which it fits into our seminar now. in terms of what are the imperatives that follow from such a doctrine, and how do they relate to the materials we've been dealing with thus far. And that's what the way I try to relate the kinds of factual, quote-unquote, materials we've been dealing with in terms of use of fuels and the shortage of metals with a doctrine which gives us some discrimination. Now, some people say that we ought to stop population growth because if we have more people, we're going to pollute more. I don't think it's a problem of pollution, so I really haven't yet seen an argument for stopping population growth. And of course, we have more people, we use up more of the natural resources, and we build more highways and destroy more mountains and do all kinds of things. But I'm not sure, but what, at least for the foreseeable future, it's not a much better direction to go, following from this doctrine of nature, to have a change in the lifestyle. That is to, because it seems to me this is important, however many people there are. The argument, you see, is not then from the practical consequences, it is from the ground of your thinking about nature. So whether there are few or many, seems to me you would treat nature in a quite different way from what we've treated it. However many people there are, if you had this doctrine of kind of the sanctity of nature and the meaningfulness of nature, apart from the practical reason, whether it's going to affect your life. Not without regard to that, but in, you know, above and beyond that.
It's really a wild out idea, but maybe we need to develop a creed.
A what?
Ecologist creed. We can say a Christian.
Well, you know, our writing that's along this line that I think is worthy of study is Teilhard de Chardin's work on the phenomenon of man and some of his other writings, which brings it up from a very historical point of view and tries to consider the problem of man into the future. And the phenomenon of man really is that he can understand the consequences of his acts that he performs today affect people 100 years from now and 1,000 years from now. And we have this new responsibility that falls on man. When he understands this, he must act rationally to do something about it. And I think this really is the nub of what we're saying. Should we act rationally in some way in relationship to the future, or do we act only in the present? And are we responsible only in the present?
There's two quickies. I think that the category of nature has to always be put together with the category of history in the Christian faith, because Christianity is an historical religion. We relate to historical events, and I think that there has been a movement from talk about the nature of history, where you say, what is history? What is the changeless essence of history? What is the nature of history? To talk about the history of nature, which is a very different kind from Bates. There has a book with that title, The History of Nature. So there you get goal, movement, process, direction, future, and all of that business. So I think that's another thing to, we ought not to talk about the nature of history, we ought to talk about the history of nature. I forget what the second book was.
That's quite a mouthful. We digest that. It'll take us a little while.
Well, all life is historical, and man has been a part of it only a very small period of this history.
This is quite a debatable doctrine, and quite, in some sense, a denied doctrine by much of the church history, as history has not been too important to the church at some point.
I think one thing that we tend to forget as Christians is that we have a lot to learn
from other people with other religions. And I think we've been so busy defining ourselves negatively, you know, in our missionary field, that just because a so-called primitive culture deals with nature or deals with their gods in a certain way, we must define ourselves negatively from that. If they do it that way, then we'll emphasize everything in the other direction. And I think one thing I see is very hopeful in the younger generation is that the kids are going back and looking at some of the wisdom of, say, the Indians, and the way the Indians related to nature, how they dealt with nature, and the kind of rapport that they had. They lived with a sense of ambiguity, which you're talking about. That there have been cultures that have done this and have done it for a long, long time and have managed to continue to preserve the resources that they were dealing with. And I think we forget that we have things like this to learn from other people, that we tend to shoot off in new directions and say we have to develop our whole new idea, a whole new way of dealing with nature, rather than saying maybe somebody else has some ideas that we could look at and draw on. They don't all have to be new.
What I heard Jim saying, and everybody hears things differently, I know, was that things have happened to nature in the last several thousand years of man's history. And we are at certain stages in terms of the population, and you can't kill it off, and you've got to live with its demands and its technology, and with our control of nature and our intervening with nature, and the pollution that's already occurred, and all kinds of things. So we don't just start de novo, and so somehow our doctrine of what we do now comes out of where we are and what's happened. That's what I heard you say. And we've got to take that seriously. We don't kind of abstract ourselves, you know, or go back to a primitive culture. We might get insight, I agree, we might get some help, but we still have to deal with the fact that we've got how many million automobiles and how many we're going to have, and Paul wants to get rid of them, but we've got them, and we've got
it. We have antibiotics. When we idealize